Hi, I'm Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Well, my Facebook feed recently had something I had never seen before. It was an animated ad promoting an upcoming Disney shareholder vote and encouraging me to vote now for Disney's 12 director nominees. Well, I supposed I shouldn't have been surprised that it was animated given that it was Disney, but what was surprising was that I am not a significant Disney shareholder. So what's going on in the House of Mouse that is driving this unusual campaign? And what are the goals of and strategies deployed by activist shareholders in the modern corporate world? We're lucky to be joined this morning by Professor Rahul Menon of the Daniels School of Business at Purdue University, who has researched and written extensively on the topic. Good morning, Professor Menon, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Hi, good morning, Allison and Roger. Thanks for having me on this show.
Professor, let's start with some corporate governance basics, the way they draw it up on the blackboard in law school. What is the relationship between shareholders, boards, and management supposed to work in theory, and what's the reality?
All right, so let's start with the theory on shareholders, board, and management, right? So shareholders are the owners of the firm, but we know ownership is dispersed, so shareholders are not managing or running the day-to-day operations of the firm. That's where the management comes in, so they are the agents acting on behalf of these owners and trying to run the operations of the firm to maximize shareholder value. But then how do you ensure that these agents are acting in the best interest of the shareholder? So the shareholders therefore elect the board of directors who are supposed to oversee the management, set their compensation, and replace any non-performing executives. So that's the theory. But in practice, what may happen is that boards may not always be acting in the best interest of shareholders. This might not be intentional. It's just that the board members might be busy people. They might be serving on multiple boards. They might be the CEOs or CFOs of other public firms. And so they might not have the bandwidth to ensure proper oversight of management. And it's also possible that the board over time develops a good relationship with management. And so in those cases, they might be more biased towards the management's point of view on matters. So that's the reality, and that's where you have these activist shareholders come in.
So what's the profile of the typical activist investor, and what's their motivation?
So a typical activist investor is an institutional investor, so probably a manager of a hedge fund that, say, manages billions of dollars of assets. And the way I think of it is the regular investor invests in the firm because they believe in the firm and they believe that the firm is going to do well. The activist invests in a firm because they believe the firm is not doing something right. And so they want to come in and kind of shake things up. So that's what the typical activist investor would look like.
So a hedge fund, let's say a hedge fund has a substantial position in a publicly traded company. Obviously, mm-hmm. if they think it's not doing things right, one possibility is they could just sell their stake, right?
Yes.
But they're taking it, but these people obviously believe that there is a better path for them. That
yes.
by taking some steps, they can actually increase shareholder stock price, right? Because that's at the end of the day, I assume all hedge funds care about is stock price. Have
yes.
I got that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, they care about it. So the typical activist would target a company with some core valuable assets, a strong business, but they feel that the company's underperforming its peers in terms of earnings or valuation, total shareholder returns. And so their objective is that, well, the company is maybe not undervalued or underpriced. It's just that their value can be increased. And so I'm going to step in and I'm going to take some steps, maybe cut costs, make operations more efficient, change executive compensation, and so stuff like that to ensure that the valuation of the company improves.
And I want to ask if this ever works. I mean, can you think of some examples that our audience might understand where an activist shareholder has aggressively pursued something, and I want you to explain what the something would be, whether it's a change in management, a change in the board, what the options are, but where an activist yes. investor has pursued something that caused yes. a positive change?
So, there are quite a few examples, right? So a lot of times the changes might not be very visible, but if you go back to like 2013, Carl Icahn targeted Apple. And at that time, Apple was sitting on this huge pile of cash, but they didn't have a policy of paying dividends. So Icahn said, that it's ridiculous that they're sitting on so much cash, they're not returning that to shareholders. So he stepped in, he took a 1% stake in Apple and kind of had talks with the management, with Tim Cook, to instate a dividend policy and a share buyback policy. And so since then, I mean, Apple has installed this this policy of paying dividends, engaging in share buybacks, and now I think they return close to $100 billion a year through buybacks and dividends. And one of the consequences of that was that Apple's PE multiples significantly improved. It got some value investors like Warren Buffett, who likes to invest in stocks that pay regular dividends. And so there are a lot of examples like this. For instance, recently, Nelson Peltz targeted Unilever and forced them to, I would not say forced them, but they kind of edged them to spin off one of their divisions, the ice cream business that sells Ben & Jerry's, and also engage in some cost-cutting measures. So there are quite a few examples where activists do come in and bring real change. It could also be a change in management, so forcing succession of CEO, bringing in a new CEO with a different perspective.
Now, Icahn is a serial activist, right? He's been doing this for as long as I can remember. And just to sort of finish out the story, so Icahn comes in, he buys 1% of Apple, he wreaks these changes. Does he then sort of sell his stake off and take some profits out of it, or does he stay involved with the company?
So the activist strategies might vary. So I think in the case of Icahn, he exited a stake in 2016, but for different reasons. So I think he was not sure about Apple's strategy in China. Sometimes activists, if they take a board seat, might stick on longer for like 6 years, 7 years. But at some point, they would like to exit their stake so that they can target another firm.
You mentioned, you know, the case with Apple being in 2013. Are activist shareholders something new? Because it definitely feels like there's a lot about it in the news today.
Yeah, I do agree. I mean, activism is not new. I mean, there have been corporate raiders since the 80s who kind of target firms, cause the firm to either go for a merger or be taken over by another firm. And so it goes back quite to the 80s, but definitely it has been increasing. Over the past decade or so, we have seen a significant rise in shareholder activism and a lot more campaigns targeting some of the even large firms.
Yeah, I suppose we can think back to Wall Street and when the Michael Douglas character targets Blue Star Airlines as an 80s activist shareholder move.
Yes. Yes.
But how does an activist shareholder campaign typically begin?
So the campaign would begin with accumulating a significant stake in a company. For a small company, it might be over 5%, but for a large company like, say, Procter & Gamble or Unilever or Apple, it might be somewhere around 1-1.5%. So you accumulate the stake, and then you kind of begin talks with management. So it starts with a formal communication of what the activist demands are. So what do you want? Do you want the company to spin off a certain division or to cut costs, increase dividends? So you communicate that. And then, of course, it goes from there. The management might accept some of the demands, might reject them, in which case you might go for the next step, which is asking for a board seat. If that gets rejected, then you get to like the more aggressive stage, which is like a proxy contest or a proxy fight, to kind of get the vote to shareholders and let them decide whether the activists should have a board seat.
And is it fair to say that if you reach the point where you're reaching out to other shareholders, management and the activists are not agreeing?
Yes. So that's when typically, right? So that's when you would want to take it public. So you might start off with taking your demands public to kind of pressure the management. So then the management might sometimes relent and say, okay, I will agree to these demands. But if the management still doesn't relent, then you get into the proxy fight where now shareholders will vote on who gets to be on the board.
You know, intuitively, when you hear that somebody takes a stake of 1%, that doesn't strike you as saying as being enough to create any interest in management to sort of pay attention to you. But it's really the threat of what you're going to do if they don't that causes the dialogue, isn't it, Professor?
Yes. So these activists, I mean, they're big players. They kind of go public with their demands. So they have communication specialists, advisors, proxy solicitors, and so they can kind of pressure the management by saying that, well, if you don't agree to what we're saying, we are going to make this a public battle, and then you're going to have to invest a lot of resources defending yourself in this battle. And so, as I said, I mean, right, the proxy contest, which is typically the last stage of an activist campaign, can be very expensive, not just for the activists, but also for the firm's management, because it's a lot of time spent defending your strategy. And so it goes into millions of dollars when you get to that stage.
And again, just so is there an example that we can point to that our listeners would understand of a famous proxy battle over the last 10 years that in a public company that actually ended up with a change in management?
So when Nelson Peltz, actually from Trion Partners, he had a big proxy battle with Procter & Gamble, which he won, actually. So that was, I'm not sure if that led to a change in management at that time, but definitely there was some succession plan that was put in place for a new CEO. But that's one of the examples that come to mind of a recent proxy battle that the activist won. These proxy battles can go either way, so it's a 50-50 chance that the activist wins the proxy battle versus the management winning the proxy battle. And the other thing is that these are not very common because it's so costly. You would typically be able to negotiate or settle before it gets to the proxy contest stage. There are definitely a lot of cases of activist campaigns where you end with a change in management.
As we've gone through, the proxy vote is towards the end, and definitely it's more of a hostile technique. Can you discuss a few non-hostile techniques that have proven effective for investors who are interested in promoting real change?
So, as I said, I mean, most activist campaigns start off as non-hostile because it's the less expensive route for the activist to take. Only one in maybe 10 campaigns actually get to the proxy contest stage. So the activist typically would start with a formal communication with the firm's management. And a lot of times management might be willing to listen to what the activist is saying. For instance, in the Icon Apple example that I mentioned, it didn't really have to get to a proxy contest stage because Apple CEO Tim Cook agreed with what the activist was saying and decided to instate a dividend policy. Similarly, at Unilever, didn't get to a proxy contest stage because the company agreed to the activist demands. Gave the activist a board seat, and then recently they decided to spin off their ice cream business because they thought that it was better off managed as a standalone business. And so it is pretty common that most campaigns are not the hostile type where you get to the proxy contest.
And you're right, and you talk about management disclosure strategies in sort of this non-hostile environment. Can you explain a little bit about, you know, what management can do to try to avoid a hostile fight?
Yes. So when you come to these campaigns, activist campaigns, what the management says is very important. Even before the activist initiates a campaign, and in particular during the period of the campaign, right? Any statement that the firm issues about their strategy is going to be publicly challenged. And so communication with investors and the media becomes very important in the middle of the campaign so that you can make them understand what the management's point of view is. And in addition, so regular communication with investors and analysts to ensure that they're on board with the management's view and the management strategy helps the management when it comes to a proxy contest, right? So if I'm someone who doesn't really communicate with my investors, then investors are less inclined to believe me when I'm in the middle of a proxy contest. And so regular communication, even before the campaign, becomes very, very important. And so most of large firms typically have what are known as firms that specialize in activism defense. So you have law firms, you have investment advisory firms, and these firms will advise you on how to defend yourself against an activist. So what to say, what strategies to promote to investors, how to increase your outreach so that maximum investors are inclined to support the management.
So we started off the segment with Roger talking about the ads he's seen with regards to Disney shareholders. What is going on at Disney?
So what's happening at Disney is that Disney has been targeted by two activist investor groups. So there's Trine Partners and Blackwell's Capital. So both these activist groups have complained that Disney has had lackluster performance over the past few years relative to peers in terms of profitability, earnings per share, price to earnings multiples, and shareholder returns. And so these two groups of activist investors, both Trian Partners and Blackwell's Capital, they believe that they have better plans to improve the profitability of Disney. And as you can see, that this particular campaign has reached the proxy contest stage where Trian Partners and Blackwell's Capital have both proposed their own nominees for the board of directors. And so with Trian, they're saying that, well, Disney needs a proper succession planning, which they don't currently have. The board doesn't have enough bandwidth to oversee the management. The half of the board are CEOs at other firms. They're not really in a position to oversee Disney. I want to improve margins of the direct-to-consumer business because they're currently low relative to peers like Netflix. And similarly, on the other hand, Blackwell's Capital is saying that, well, Disney is a sum of three different businesses. You have entertainment, experiences, direct-to-consumer, and so it's better off managed as two or three separate companies.
But what
we are seeing is that the board and the management has not agreed to these activist demands, which is why we are at this this current stage.
So this sounds really complicated to me. If we have two different activist groups, are they each proposing their own slate of additional directors? And how would someone win? I'm really confused.
So each has their own slate of directors. So now there are 12 directors up for election. Disney has its own slate of 12 directors. Trian has proposed two directors that are not in that slate. So they are okay with 10 of those 12. They're not okay with two. And so they are suggesting to shareholders that they vote for Trian's two directors instead of the two that Disney has suggested. And Blackwell's has its own three nominees that they would like investors to vote. So investors can vote for 12 directors. And so they can choose to vote with all of Disney's nominees. They can select Trian's nominees, or they can select Blackwell's nominees. So it will depend on who gets the majority votes. So the majority will win.
I've certainly read about and have some understanding of proxy fights and how they've been done in the past. And normally, as I understand it, the efforts are dedicated toward focusing on large shareholders because they have lots of votes. You know, the Vanguards of the world, where the index fund has massive numbers of shares.
Yes.
It was really interesting to me to see this thing on Facebook. Is it unusual for, a company in a proxy fight to go on social media and almost randomly target people who have small, if any, shareholdings?
So that's part of the whole activism defense strategy. And in particular case of Disney, it's all the more prominent because Disney happens to have a huge retail investor base. So Disney is a popular brand, right? So everybody has heard of it. And so unlike a lot of other firms, Disney's investor base is 40% comprised of retail investors.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so that's a big chunk of investors who normally don't really care much about who the board is going to be, who's going to be on the board, right? And so you have to really push these investors to put in their votes. They're not going to attend the annual shareholder meeting for the most part, and a lot of them might not even mail their proxy cards. And so through this relentless media blitz, you want to kind of force these shareholders to send their proxy cards.
Yeah, I suppose like so many people, you know, if you have, you know, even a small stock portfolio, you get these proxy things in the mail, and I suppose most people just look at them and toss them in the trash.
Yes. And so that's why this whole campaign, like if you each company, like the company and the activists have their own websites, they have presentation materials, you have ads being run on social media, so to kind of make this big enough so that the normal retail investor takes notice and decides to put in their vote.
You know, a contest like this is really expensive, and you think about it, you know, they're trying to get like two board members or three board members. It seems like a lot of heft for, you know, a marginal sort of change in steerage of corporate governance. I guess before we go, I sort of wanted to ask you, we started out by talking about what the theory of corporate governance is. Before we go, I wanted to see if you had any observations about, you know, where there are defects in the way that corporations operate in terms of protecting shareholder interests in the current environment, what kinds of big changes, if any, would you like to see happen to sort of facilitate a more efficient sort of approach?
Yeah, so I guess that's a very...
A very broad question. I just wanted to hear your observations.
Broad and also a little tough question in the sense that, I mean, there's definitely... when you think of it, I mean, there's definitely, in the U.S. especially, a lot of... measures taken by the SEC to protect common shareholders' interests, right? So to enhance disclosure requirements by the firm and the auditor, and then, of course, rules that enable shareholders to question the firm's management and to kind of make sure that there's enough pressure on management that they don't deviate from their fiduciary duty towards the firm's shareholders. And so I think one of the interesting things that happened last year was what's known as the universal proxy rule. So, because we are talking about activists, and so that's really interesting in the context of shareholder activism, is that in 2023, the SEC brought this rule where previously, when firms would email these proxy cards to shareholders to vote for the nominees, the proxy card sent by the firm would only have the firm's list of nominees. It wouldn't have any nominees proposed by an activist investor, for instance. And so a shareholder who doesn't plan on attending the shareholder meeting would have to go with either the firm's nominees or they would have to go with the activist's nominees. So they couldn't pick and choose between the two different slates of directors. But in 2023, SEC brought this universal proxy rule. And under this rule, now, when the firm mails their proxy card to investors, it must contain all nominees, both the firm's nominees as well as any dissident nominees. So in this case, in the case of Disney, it would have to contain the nominees proposed by Trian Partners and by Blackwell's Capital. And so now the investor who is mailing their proxy card back to the firm can pick and choose between the different sets of nominees, which I think is a big step in empowering the shareholder and kind of making them better equipped to put the people on the board whom they would like to see. And so I feel like policies like this or rules like this that empower the shareholder, and because the shareholder's power is to select the board, right? That's what they can do to influence the firm. And so rules are policies that allow shareholders to better pick the right people to serve on the board is what I would like to see more of from the SEC. So that's kind of like my take, right? So empowering shareholders to make this more democratic.
We appreciate your spending time with us. That's an interesting take, and I think a good one. We didn't mention that the Disney proxy fight is being waged by, once again, Nelson Peltz, who keeps popping up in these stories. Be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah. So he has a history of going through these proxy fights. So I think the last one he had was against Procter & Gamble, which was again a very public campaign, which he won. But he has also had some losses, I think in particular against DuPont in 2015, where his nominees lost. So it will be interesting. So the vote is on April 3rd, actually. So I'm really looking forward to the outcome of this particular contest.
Thank you, Professor Menon.
Obesity is among the most pressing public health concerns in the United States. Government agencies and medical associations have raised concerns about obesity trends, but they show no signs of abating. Although effective obesity treatments are available, access remains a challenge. Medicare and most private insurance plans do not cover them. Allison Sexton Ward, research scientist at the University of Southern California's Schaefer Center, researched how Medicare coverage of weight loss drugs could provide a value to society. Allison joins us this morning to delve into her research with us. Allison, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Let's begin. Can you define the impacts obesity has on Medicare costs and costs to society in general?
Sure, yes. Obesity is a disease that affects over 40% of adults in the U.S., and it's associated with increased rates of many chronic and costly conditions, including diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, disability, many forms of cancer, and the list goes on. And so obviously these diseases, as we increase the prevalence, we're also increasing healthcare costs. We also estimate, previous studies have also shown that over 300,000 Americans die each year from obesity-related conditions. However, we as economists also want to look at how diseases such as obesity impact patients' quality of life. So study shows that having obesity has a huge negative impact on how patients perceive their quality of life, greater than, say, aging 20 years from age 30 to 50, or a greater impact on quality of life than being a current smoker. And then finally, economists also would look at how obesity rates have an impact on productivity and in the workforce. And so really, if we move on to the indirect impact, obesity can be very far-reaching on its costs to society.
Now, in your studies, have you focused just on Medicare, or have you focused more broadly on healthcare for the population as a whole?
Our research has covered both. The most recent paper that we put out was directly focusing on Medicare because there's legislation in Congress, the Treat and Reduce Obesity Act, which is pushing for Medicare to overturn their sort of years-long moratorium on coverage for these drugs, but we've looked at the benefits of covering them broadly across society.
Okay, so in terms of the analysis, I take it what you would do is you would say, okay, the baseline cost that we associate for Medicare beneficiaries with obesity-related diseases is X. The cost of supplying these drugs is Y, and sort of try to compare the differences between those two. Have I basically got that right?
Yeah, what we do at the Schaefer Center is we have a simulation model that brings in nationally representative survey data, years and years of survey data, and we are able to estimate the association between different diseases and other outcomes, whether they are economic or other. So we are estimating the costs associated with every level of BMI, essentially. And so we look at how reducing weight for some portion of the population can impact economic and health outcomes. And so we look at what the medical costs are associated with that. I think the trickier end of this is then predicting what uptake rates will be for these drugs into the future and what the costs will be. A lot of the analysis right now that's in the popular press is assuming that the list price of these drugs is the actual price paid by everybody, and that that price would be constant into the future. And neither of those assumptions are true.
I guess one critical question I would have along those lines is the extent to which some of the most popular sort of weight loss drugs will go generic within a reasonable amount of time, which I assume would cause a dramatic price difference.
Absolutely. But even before then, I think more drugs will continue to enter the market and prices will drop just based on the branded competition. And we've seen this in other disease areas. I think one of the most prominent ones or more recent was with the therapies for hepatitis C. So when those launched, about a decade or so ago, Sovaldi was over $84,000 for treatment. And within 12 months, there was another competitor drug on the market and prices had fallen dramatically. I think the same is true with these. And so even the more recent approval of Tirzepatide or Zepbound will cause more competition in the space and drive prices down. And that might not be the list prices that we all see on the website, but the negotiated prices between payers and manufacturers will fall.
Absolutely. So as part of this discussion, again, what we're talking about is these new weight loss medications that are on the market. Can you give an overview of the new medications and why they're changing the discussion?
Yes. So new weight loss drugs, we all refer to, they are GLP-1 drugs. They are what commonly known as Ozempic or Wegovy is one, semaglutide or Zepbound or Mounjaro. They are once weekly injections that were initially approved to treat patients for diabetes, but they were shown to have efficacy at generating weight loss. And clinical trials suggest that patients safely lose between 16 and 20% of their body weight on average. And what's really important here is that the side effect profile for these drugs is much better than their predecessors. So they have less of a gastrointestinal impact. They have less cardiac impact. So they're more tolerable. They are once weekly injections, which might not be exciting for everybody, but I think the pipeline is moving towards finding a pill version of this also. But I think it's also important to note that as more trials are happening, the benefits from these drugs extend beyond weight loss also. And so we're seeing reduced risk of cardiovascular events for patients with heart disease, and we're seeing improvements for patients with chronic kidney disease. So these drugs are really changing the market in that they are more effective and more tolerable than anything else we've seen.
So when you do your modeling, what kind of assumptions do you make about the future costs of these drugs? In other words, we just talked about implications, but obviously, I suppose you have to run multiple simulations. But you know, what kind of projections are you thinking these drugs could end up costing in the future?
So, we haven't modeled the costs in our. So, what we've focused on to date is the benefits, and that's because the assumptions around the costs are very tricky. I think
exactly.
In the long run, once we hit generic, you see drugs falling to, you know, prices falling by 80 or 90%. We already see there's already estimates of what the rebates are on these, the average rebates are on these drugs, and they are somewhere like 50 to 70% off list price. So we already are seeing huge reductions in what's being paid for the drugs. I think what the big important factors for driving down the prices are, one, increasing access, right? Mm-hmm. So as more patients take these drugs, the competition for formulary space will increase, and therefore the rebates will increase. And then also how quickly more drugs will come to market, which I think is, again, a function of coverage, right? So the incentives to get these drugs to market faster will increase if we see more broad coverage for them.
So you've talked about, you know, some of those health costs that would be reduced as people were to decrease obesity. with regards to whether it's like heart attacks or other types of things. What type of dollar amount have you started putting towards this? What has the calculations that you've begun, what is that starting to show?
Yeah, so we see a lot of cost offsets, right? So we show that covering these medications will generate cost offsets for Medicare, but also in the private insurance market. Also, I think our estimates were that Medicare could see $1 trillion in cost offsets in 10 years, or, you know, roughly speaking, $100 billion a year over those first 10 years. I think there's a few things that are important to note. One, the cost offsets from treating obesity grow over time. So if I lose weight tomorrow, my healthcare costs don't necessarily go down immediately. It's really the prevention or the delaying of the chronic costly conditions associated with it. So delaying the onset of diabetes or something like that. And that takes years to sort of see those costs play out. The other thing is that treating patients earlier in their obesity lifespan is important, right? So before they get all of the chronic conditions associated with obesity. So we see that the greatest value is generated from treating patients younger so that they live a life free of obesity. I think those are two very important pieces of all of this. We can't think about the cost offset flowing to tomorrow. Oh, one other thing I wanted to mention is that a huge benefit from treatment comes in the quality of life too, which I think this conversation around weight loss drugs has focused so intently on whether they pay for themselves in the form of cost offsets. And that is not a threshold that we have held other drugs to at launch, right? So if we look at the benefits in terms of quality of life and cost offsets, the value is enormous, but the conversation has focused entirely on cost offsets so far.
I have a clarification on the calculations. When you did the calculations that showed that Medicare was going to save money over time, did that also include then private insurers covering the weight loss drugs for people to be treated at a younger age before they got to the Medicare system?
Yeah, so we ran both scenarios. So that $1 trillion over 10 years was assuming Medicare coverage alone. And you made a great point that the biggest cost offsets are generated from
earlier. Yeah.
The biggest Medicare cost offsets are generated from private insurance covering the drugs. So again, people getting access to the drugs earlier in life, and then when they reach 65 and age into Medicare, they're much healthier than they otherwise would have been. So the greatest value is really seen by that combination of both Medicare and private insurance covering the drugs.
You made an important point that money and economics aren't the only factors at play here at all, particularly when you're talking about quality of life. Having said that, when I started to read and think about this, I wondered, obesity does tend to create premature death. So in terms of doing overall cost savings, do you have to do an analysis that asks the questions, okay, if these people aren't treated with weight loss drugs, they will die earlier, which will save us years of healthcare costs that we don't have to pay. And I suppose while we're at it, we take into the fact that there'll be a lot of uncollected Social Security. So doesn't there have to be a sort of a more fulsome, if we're going to just look at money, which I'm not sure we should, but if we're going to look at money, don't you have to do that more fulsome analysis?
Yeah, I think that's another great point that you've raised, is that when we have life-extending drugs, they end up being costly because we're extending life and then therefore have to pay for the medical costs during that extra life. It's the perverse way to think of things. But what we did in our analysis is we did not tax patients for their life extension. And that's one of the ways that we thought about the benefits here. I think there's different viewpoints on how you do that. I think one of the things that treating obesity does also is it allows people to be in the workforce. It reduces disability claims. And so the model that we have at the Schaefer Center takes all of this into account. And so it's estimating their tax base. It's looking at disability and all of these things. But for our benefit, for our cost analysis, we did not include the costs associated with the life years generated from treatment.
So as we wrap up our conversation, I'd like to just have you talk briefly about how covering obesity treatments reduces health disparities.
Yeah, that's another great point. And as we look across the population, we see that obesity has impacted minority populations at greater rates. And so whereas the overall obesity rate is in among adults in the U.S. is 40%, it's 60% among African Americans. And one of the things I think then also, if you look at the rates of all of those condition, chronic conditions associated with obesity, we see higher rates in Hispanic and African American populations. And so one of the things that the literature has shown is that as you simplify treatment regimens, it has beneficial impacts on these health disparities. And so the idea, I think, is that the intensive behavioral therapy and the diet and exercise recommendations takes time and other resources to adhere to. And so as simplifying the treatment will allow a greater part of the population to adhere and get the benefits. And so I think we've also seen in the literature that intensive behavioral therapy is less effective in minority populations. So it's very true that our expectation is with broader coverage for weight loss drugs that we would see a huge improvement in health disparities, not just in obesity rates, but in a lot of these other conditions that are associated with obesity.
We've been spending time with Allison Sexton Ward. She's a research scientist at the University of Southern California's Schaefer Center, and she researches how Medicare coverage of weight loss drugs could provide a value to society. Allison, thank you so much for joining us on Mountain Money.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Finishing School's goal is to teach children how to sew while expressing their creativity and boosting their confidence. Located in Heber City, the Finishing School is a legacy of the original that opened in Salt Lake City in 1982. Joining us this morning to share more about this unique business is Madison Banks. Madison, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
The Finishing School in Heber City is a legacy of the Salt Lake Finishing School. Can you share your connection and what made you choose Heber City as a location for the next school?
Yeah, so my grandmother is Sue Hess Fenton. She opened the original Finishing School in Salt Lake. So I grew up going there every day after school as a child, and then later helped her run it as a teenager. And then after that, I moved back east for college and opened another school, Finishing School Falls Church in Northern Virginia, for almost 10 years, and then sold it and moved back to Utah in early 2023. And I chose Heber City as a location for this school this time because I saw it as a new market without sewing lessons available anywhere around there.
That's true. I know, you know, oftentimes it's one of those skills that either you learn at home or isn't something that you're able to do. Can you talk a little bit about what types of projects do the students make at the Finishing School?
Yeah, so we have tons of projects to choose from, shorts, aprons, oven mitts, dresses, different clothing items, holiday decorations, stuffed animals, and quilts. We're always adding new projects every month, too, so it's really fun.
And what kind of ages are your students typically? Let's try again. What kind of ages do you typically serve?
Ages 8 through 15.
And then, you know, how do the classes typically work? Are they structured where everyone's working on the same project? Do they go for a certain number of weeks? If I, you know, went to your website, what would I start to find?
Yeah, so all of the classes are structured the same, where every student is working on something different depending on their level of experience and preference. And you can buy a tuition package of like 5, 10, or 20 lessons and then kind of plug in when your child is available to come to class. So come and go as you please.
Can you talk a little bit about the skill set that's involved in learning to sew. Are these people working on machines, or do they work manual? I'm just trying to visualize what happens in the class.
Yeah, so we do machine sewing and hand sewing. We do ironing, pattern layout, fabric cutting, serging. We sew on buttons, applique, zippers. They learn how to alter clothing, hem clothing, do patchwork, so all sorts of things.
It sounds like some skills I myself may need. But right now you just serve children, right?
Yes, we're just doing kids right now, but hopefully we'll expand to adult classes in the future.
And I think a lot of times people see sewing as a lost art. You know, how do you describe, you know, the benefits of sewing and why someone should enroll their child into these classes?
Yeah, I think everyone should know basic sewing skills. You know, I feel like everyone always ends up with like a piece of clothing that they need to shorten, or they have a tear or a button that falls off or whatnot. And it's also just a fun way for kids to like get off the screens and work with their hands and take their time. And it's not like a competition. It really is art and relaxing.
In the 21st century, we are seeing an increasing breakdown in stereotypes. Having said that, how many of your students are boys?
I actually do have a lot of boys. I would say like one third are boys.
Wow.
So that's been really fun.
And I think, you know, again, as you've mentioned, sewing's got just a lot of creativity and skill. I have two boys, and when they were younger, I loved going to the fabric stores. Is that something that you have? Are they able to purchase patterns and fabrics there? Or is that something that you have a relationship with another business in the community?
Yeah, so I buy all of the supplies wholesale, and so when the students come to class, they don't need to bring anything. We use Bernina sewing machines and sergers, and we use the Lara Star irons, and then they can choose from like hundreds of different fabrics depending on what project they want to do. We use fleece, flannel, cotton, knit, and so it's kind of like a mini fabric store in there, to be honest, and it's really fun for the kids to pick out which colors they want to match together.
Now, earlier in the interview, you mentioned that there was some, you know, you try to have classes so that, you know, parents can find times and their children can attend. What kind of hours do you run classes?
Yeah, so we do weekday afternoons. We do Monday and Thursdays right now. We do 4:30, 5:30, 6:30, just hour-long classes, and then we do Friday mornings at 9 and 10, and then we do every other Saturday at 11, 12, and 1.
Very nice. And I know a lot of parents, April 1st is kind of the first date where summer camps open up. Are you offering any kind of summer camps, or are you looking at offering a schedule during the summer as well?
Yeah, we do classes all year round. So it'll be the same schedule during the summer, just those hour-long classes available for the kids to come when they can.
That's great. And then as well, you know, I know that these skills can be, you know, transferred to other types of things, whether a kid's in theater or, you know, you see like Project Runway and other types of classes like this. Having done a finishing school, being a part of one in Salt Lake City and then in Virginia, have you seen kids take this skill further in their lives?
Yeah, I have. I've had students at my past shop in Virginia move on to do like quilt competitions and work in the theater and do costume design and whatnot. I had one of my students who was with me for a long time, and now she's at a design school in New York designing costumes, and she's a really good seamstress because she took from me for a long time. So
very nice. How can listeners find out more about the school, and how many students do you take at a time for each of those hour sessions?
Yeah, so we can have up to 6 kids at once in a class, and they can find out more info by going to our website, which is finishingschoolheber.com, or you can call and text us at 435-709-6519.
And is the finishing school still operational in Salt Lake City?
Yes, so my grandmother retired and sold it in 2019, but it has a new owner and it's still running today, so.
You mentioned earlier that you had, do you have some plans to sort of add adult classes as well?
Yeah, in the future. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Very exciting. Well, it's been really exciting to get to talk with you, Madison Banks, owner of the Finishing School located in Heber City. Thanks so much for spending time on Mountain Money. You've been listening to KPCW's Mountain Money. If you like Mountain Money, let us know. Please leave a review.